Today is Thursday, July 21st, 2022. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Ronnie McFarland, M-C-F-A-R-L-A-N-D, and Ronnie goes by Ronnie Mac. Good evening, Ronnie. How are you today?
I'm good. How about yourself?
I'm good. Thank you for asking. Ronnie, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Last time we left off in 1979, I think with your first job working for the John F. Beasley Construction Company with a man named Rick Peters on the Seed House in Oklahoma City. Can you pick that story up?
Yes. We was wrapping that project up, and Virgil Rapp was the superintendent running the job, and he asked me if I wanted to go to work, you know, out of state for Beasley. I said, well, what do you got? He said, well, they had a 29-story high-rise going to Cincinnati.
Wow.
And I asked what it paid, and he got all the particulars. And at the time, there in Oklahoma City, I was making about $9.35 an hour.
Okay.
And the scale in Cincinnati was higher, so that was like 15 something, so that was a pretty good bump.
Wow.
And that's going to pay $125 a week subsistence.
Okay.
So I was like, sure, I'll go. So I went to Cincinnati. A guy by the name of Kenny Joe Runyon was running that job.
Okay.
And I spent, you know, probably the next 10, 11, 12 years mainly working for him. Whenever it would get slow, they would send me to, like, Dallas on a Beasley job, or I'd go to a bridge job somewhere. They'd send me somewhere to keep me busy, but I worked a lot up in Ohio throughout the 80s up until about 91 or so.
What can you talk me through a couple of the more interesting jobs you did in that 10-year time period?
Pretty long. Well, let's see, I did that 29-story in Cincinnati, right downtown. And then when we finished it, there was going to be like a 2-month lull before Kenny's next job, and it was up in Toledo. But
okay.
Basically had a 50-story going in Dallas, called Placid Oil at the time. It's called Thanksgiving Tower now.
Hmm.
And they needed help down there, so I ended up going to Dallas and working on that.
What was your job there with them? What were you doing?
In Dallas?
Yeah.
I did everything. Whatever crew was shorthanded, that's what I did. One day I'd lay deck, and the next day I'd bolt up. The next day I'd hook on. The next day I'd connect. It's just like, you know, if somebody was missing, I'd just fill in the void. It didn't matter.
Okay. Nice.
See, we finished that, topped that building out, in May of like 81.
Okay.
And then they had two bridge jobs going. Both of them was up in Illinois. One was like in Peoria, and the other one was in Moline. And Ed Kent was on one of them, and Lamar, Ed's brother, was on the other one.
Okay.
And I was going to go up there to it, but they had river flooding or something, and they was kind of shut down. And then they had a 31-story office building in Columbus that I was supposed to go to, but they couldn't get the foundations in time. So there was a lull in there, and the business agent out of Oklahoma City, he knew I was home, and he called and told me about a bridge job over at Mountain Home, Arkansas, for Broad, Bolt, and Conant. And I called that superintendent, who's Kenny Upton, and he was having a hard time getting help because he was out of the Little Rock local, and Mountain Home's a pretty good drive from Little Rock. And it was a big girder bridge, bigger than the one I just done here, but it had big girders on it. So we went across the North Fork Lake, so the bridge was over a mile long.
Wow.
And I ended up going up there and working on that bridge from right before, probably about the 1st of June till the middle of October. And then they were ready at Columbus, and I went up there and connected on that AEP building.
So this was in October 1981?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we topped that building out in April of 82. And then I had to have my knee operated on because of a bull ride wreck. So I went home and had my knee operated on, and I was home, I guess, about 2 weeks. And W.D. Whitaker, who was the superintendent for Beasley in Dallas, he had a lot of work going on, and he called me to come down there on one of them projects. So I went to Dallas, was working on the Arco Tower for Atlantic Richfield Oil Company. And they was up about 25 floors when I got there. So I topped that building out. I was running the phones for one of the derricks.
So hang on a second. Now I've got a bunch of questions. Let's go back a second. You had already had knee surgery from that, the time when that bull stepped on your knee.
Yeah, but that was number two.
Okay. Okay, and then I want to go back a little. You mentioned Ed Kent and his brother Lamar were working on two bridges in Illinois.
Yeah.
Had you worked for them?
I had worked for either one of them. I had met Lamar. He come through Dallas one time, and he come out by the job and quit, you know, brought him around, and I was introduced to him, and, you know, of course, my hands ain't real big, but Lamar has what I call grizzly bear hands, this big old monster, big hands, you know, and he shook my hand and wrapped all the way, you know, around my hand.
Huh. Did Ed have the same hands?
No. Ed's hands were kind of like mine, kind of normal.
Okay.
Lamar had giant hands. Hmm. Of course, Lamar was a big man.
Was he? Okay. Now, Ed was a tall guy.
Oh, yeah. Ed was tall and skinny. Ed's the only guy I've ever seen in my life that could walk up to a pickup truck and just put one leg over in the back of it and stand there.
Wow.
The other leg's still on the ground, up one leg up in the back of a pickup truck.
Wow. Okay. And Lamar, was Lamar as tall as Ed or a little shorter, just broader?
Lamar was probably 6 inches or so shorter.
Okay.
Than Ed, but Lamar was real stocky built, where Ed was just tall and skinny.
Okay. All right. And then you've mentioned the connecting gang and hooking up and bolting up and you know, putting down the decking. That was, I think you'd mentioned that once before, but can you talk to me about the phones? When I think of a phone, well, I'm talking to you on the phone. Can you kind of explain to me what that's all about?
Okay. Well, on the high rise, you know, nowadays they don't use guide derricks hardly ever anymore.
What's a guide derrick?
Well, a guide derrick is something that has been around, you know, for ever since the ever since they started building skyscrapers. It's a it has a steel structured mast, and then they can vary in length. But on most high rises, the mast will be 120 feet tall.
Okay.
And it sits like on the floor you're building, or the last floor you built.
Okay.
It stands up above it, and it's got steel guy cables that come down and attach to the columns around the edge of the building. So you usually have anywhere from, you know, 6, 7, 8 guy lines on the derrick, and then it has a boom that pins to the base of it. The cable runs, your hoist sets on the ground, and your cables will come from the hoist over through a fairlead shiv and then come up through the building, and they go up through the base of the derrick, and you'll have three different drums on the hoist. The far back drum is for your boom line. Your middle drum is for your main load, and then your front drum is for your whip line, which is, it's just a single part line. So you're going up the building. The operator is sitting on the ground, so he can't see nothing.
Okay.
So the guy on the phones tells that operator what to do.
Okay. And
I'll go through a little scenario of what that sounds like.
Please.
Okay. We're up on the building, you know, working, and I'll pick the phone up, and I say, all right, we're going to boom out here. We're going to boom down about 25 or 30 feet and shake this bundle of deck out. You know, he'll get out there close, you know, another 5 feet on your boom, man, hold your boom, coming down on your whip line. You know, coming down here 35, 40 feet, another 15, another 10, another 5, 3, 2, 1. All right, hold that. Then we put the shakeout hooks on there. So, all right, shakeout hooks are on the hook, work it up. About 30 feet, pick the excess cable up off the deck and hold that a minute. Guys will hook one up and say, all right, working up to roll this beam up. And it's kind of like, okay, you're up, all right, hold that, coming down. And then while you're right there by the bundle of iron, it's just like, all right, slack, get loose, working back up, slack, get loose, working back up. He's just back and forth because he's just rolling. The operator knows he's just rolling them beams up, and it'll make a sound. Just, every time you set one down, pow, it'll make a pop noise where the beam hits on the four bys you have scattered across the deck that's right above a beam so you don't crush the deck.
Okay.
And it just makes a popping noise, but when you're around it, you can tell, okay, there, you know, you can be 6, 8, 10 floors below them, and you can tell by the sound. All right, they're shaking out. They're hanging iron. I mean, you can just tell by the sound, because each one of them's got a distinctive sound to it.
But I imagine when the operator of the drums is 25 floors below you, he's not going to... That sound of what's going on in your world, he's going to be really relying on what you're saying on the phone.
Well, and he
Okay. Ah, got it. All right. Thank you.
He's sitting down there with a headset on.
Okay.
To me, a good phone man paints a good enough picture for he's got it in his mind. He knows what's going on up there.
Okay. Great.
Which is, all right, we're going. And I always gave them operators, you know, like a 11 by 17 or 8.5 by 11 or whatever sheets, and it would show the outline of the building, and each bay has a different number.
Okay.
For shipping purposes, okay, so you have like a, and they'd be like labeled A, B, C, D, you know, each bay would have an alphabetical letter attached to it.
Okay.
And like, say we was taking iron from the street, the guys on the street would rig one up and they'd start sending it to me. Well, when you're standing up there on the edge of the building looking down at it, you know, looking good, keep it coming. And then when it got up close to the top, you know, I'd always be like, and booming up. Well, he'd reach over and start booming up too, and he's still getting up. And then, you know, once he was high enough to clear the building, he'd be like, and hold your load. Keep booming up.
Okay.
Going all the way to the mast. That let him know he was booming all the way up tight. And he'd have a paint mark on his drum down there that let him know whenever he was high boomed.
Hmm. Okay.
And he'd have a paint mark let him know when, on all of his drums when he was, you know, as high as he could go. And every time you'd jump, you know, we'd jump every week, you know, you'd jump 2 4s, you know, take the iron, shake it out, set it, jump the derrick. I mean, it's just the same process over and over and over.
Okay. Just moving the derrick up as your floors were completed.
Yeah, and it jumps itself as you kick the boom out from away from the mast, and the base of the boom sets in what's called a jump block. And then you have cables that run that attach to the, like 30 feet up the mast, from the base, and they run up through a shiv at the top of the boom, back down to the base of the boom through another shiv, and you just drop your big load line down and catches it. Then as you start coming up on that big load, he plays off on his boom cable, it just picks the mast straight up.
Hmm.
Get the mast up as high as you need to go.
Okay.
Slide the jump beams back underneath it for what holds the derrick up. Said, touch it down, make sure all your guy lines are right. And once you get into the typical floors, you don't have to rework guy lines. But like down there, when you first start out on the high rise, a lot of times you'll have to rework guy lines every time you jump for the first 6 or 8 times because the building changes.
Huh, okay.
So the length you had at one floor might not work on the next floor. You know, so you'll get jumped up there and just touch the mast down. Then you got to, you know, pull you out 4 guys that'll hold you up there. And they'll then pull your boom up, you know, and then go around to each one reworking them before you can start taking iron.
Okay. And it's the drums on the ground that are actually lifting the derrick up to its next area.
Yes.
That's pretty clever. Okay. So that's a guide derrick.
And then like on the bridge projects, Beasley had a couple of big stiff leg derricks that old man John F. designed himself.
Huh.
200-ton and 150-ton. Well, a stiff leg derrick, it's got 2 legs that hold it up. So if you just figure a center mass that comes from the base up, say 150 feet, and then at 90 degree angles off of that, you've got a leg that's coming down in like a 45 that attaches to the seal work. That's what holds the mast up, and then your boom is outboard of it. And that 200-ton derrick had 300 feet of main boom and 75 foot of jib, which is a smaller boom section that comes off the very tip, and you usually just have like a single part line off of it. But on the on that 200 ton that old man John designed, halfway up the jib, it had a five-part belly line, we called it. So the hoist for that derrick had four drums.
Huh. Okay.
Had the boom, the main load, the belly line, and the whip.
Okay.
And then and that off and that hoist would be down on the barge with the derrick, but you still had bones on him because he's watching the drums, and he you know, whenever he could see you or whatever, he would, but most of the time you have to tell him what to do.
Okay. And I'm my head's spinning because I'm thinking this whole thing is sitting on a barge. I mean, that barge has to be anchored in pretty well. It can't be, you know, going here and there.
Well, I mean, if, when you're in shallow enough water, we've got what's called spuds, which are just big pieces of pipe that you'll drop down through a guide and sink in the mud to hold the barge in place.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. I have just hit a button, and I'm going to have to call Ronnie back. Ronnie, I hit the wrong button here. I apologize. You were talking about holding the derrick in place by putting pipes down in the mud through these guides.
It's called spuds.
Okay.
And they'll vary. Most of the time, they were probably be about a 24-inch diameter heavy wall pipe.
Wow.
And they, you know, and they would be usually about, you know, 60 foot long.
Okay.
But she had hooked onto him with the derrick, and he'd like lift it up, and they had holes every so often, and you could put a pin in there. You know, an inch and a half round solid bar would go through there, and you could come down. And that would hold the spud up where you where the tug could move the barge around, and when you got where you wanted to go, the tug would hold you in place. And you hook back onto that spud and pull it up, pull the pin out of it, and drop it down until it, you know, sunk in the mud to hold you there. Then if you got out in the deeper water, too deep for your spuds, there was another hoist on the barge there that would have, we'd usually have a pair of them. They have a two-drum hoist. One side would work anchors on one side of the barge, the other side would work anchors on the other side. So, and those cables would come off and go through some fleet shears above the deck of the barge to the corners. And when you go to pull your anchors out, you come off, say, the right side corner. Well, that you'd pull that anchor off out toward the left side, like going in a 45. Where your cables were X when you pulled your anchor lines out front and back.
Okay.
And the reason for that was you could get up on the right side two cables and mud off on the left side two cables and just move your barge over, you know, several feet. You know, sometimes even a couple of hundred feet. Where you needed to work at, and just by getting up and down on those anchor lines.
Right, just relying on your anchors, but moving the barge by pulling on the cables. Okay.
And then depending on how swift the water you was in, a lot of times it would always keep a tug up close to the barge in case we lost an anchor, like when we were setting. When we was erecting iron with it, we'd always have the tug close to the barge on the downstream side, so in case we lost an anchor, we wouldn't just be at the mercy of the current taking
right.
us down the river.
Right. That makes sense.
The tug would hold us in place, and we'd bring another smaller tug around or whatever to catch the anchor line if we had to pull a anchor line up and get it repositioned or whatever.
Then what replaced the guide derrick?
Tower cranes.
Okay.
Well, and they were a lot of work, and a lot of people were scared of them and didn't want to work that hard. And as society has evolved with all these smartphones that make people dumber.
Hmm.
yeah. More and more contractors just, they still use them every now and again in New York City and Chicago, but.
Hmm.
Beasley was probably the last big steel erector that had a large fleet of guide derricks and, used them on high rises all the time. But when the high rise market kind of petered out there in the early 90s, well, then that was kind of the end of the era for the guide derricks. Everybody from then on just kind of went with, started using tower cranes all the time.
And when I think of a tower crane, we live in a town where our tallest building is, I think, 5 stories high. So a tower crane kind of makes sense in this tiny little town. But when you've got to go 50 stories or 25 or 30, the tower crane has to be on the building, doesn't it?
No, they run up the side of the building.
Okay. All right.
And then, like every 5 or 6 floors, you'll have a tie-in collar that ties it back to the building.
Okay.
And then, as you keep adding sections, going vertical, keep building up.
Yep.
You just keep adding tie-ins, where the engineer says you need them at.
That makes sense.
It's usually when we'd have to jump a tower crane. Most of the time we'd jump, 4 or 5 sections at a night. Most of the time we'd jump them at night when there's less people on the project working.
Okay.
And it usually takes, 6 to 8 hours to jump a tower crane 5 sections, which would be 100 feet. Each of those sections are 20 foot. Well, 19, 11, and whatever. I just call them 20 footers.
Right, right. And would the tower crane need somebody on the phone as well?
Oh, yeah, you always have somebody flagging it.
Okay. Because I'm thinking the tower crane, that guy can see what's going on. I would like to think it could.
He can see, but you still always have somebody flagging him because.
Okay.
He's on one side of the building. You need to do something on the other side.
Mm.
It's just easier to have a phone system or a two-way radio or whatever. Most of the time nowadays they use what's called a McKee system. It's hardwired, runs up the tower to talk to them with.
Okay.
Back in the old guide derrick days, we just used old military style handsets from like World War II that had the crystals in them.
Uh huh. Yep.
They worked good. What I liked about them, you could tell by the sound if you had connection because it would have a little echo kind of sound to it.
Okay, so on that Arco Tower, you start into that 25 floors up. And that was in 81? No, that's in 82.
82.
Okay.
And then we topped that building out. Oh, it was in the fall. Like maybe October, November. And then that building had three derricks on it when we were setting it.
Wow.
When we got it set out, I took two of them down, but we left one on one corner that we had rented out to the general contractor to hoist ductwork, drywall, all that stuff that has to go up in on the building.
Right.
So I ended up running phones during the day on that. Then I would go a block and a half over to Inner First Plaza, which was a 64-story high-rise, and I'd run the phones at night over there setting precast.
Wow.
They would hang iron during the day, and we'd set precast at night, and they couldn't get a phone man, so I'd do double duty. But when Friday come around payday, well, I had a check from two jobs, so I was doing pretty good.
You bet you were. But you're probably working, 20-hour days? I don't know, 18-hour days?
Usually about 18.
Okay. All right. And then where'd you go?
That would have got us up to end of 83. And I left Dallas in like May of 83 and went to Cincinnati to do a 35-story Lynn Clay office tower. 6th and Vine Street, right downtown Cincinnati.
Okay.
And it wasn't a real enormously heavy job, but it was a tough job. We had two derricks on it. Turner was the general contractor, and they had us working 6 days a week. We'd work 10 hours a day hanging iron, and then anywhere from 2 to 4 to 6 hours more hoisting shit for everybody else. I'd have to hoist wire mesh and rebar for the rod busters, and we'd have to make trash runs, clean the excess decking and stuff off the building.
Right.
Hoist the ductwork and shit for other trades.
That's a long days. 6 days a week. I mean, the overtime's got to be really good, but...
We finished that right before Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And they had a little, like a 9 or 10-story building up north of town. And they sent me up there and just... They had hired a new guy to run it, and they kind of sent me up there just to kind of babysit him, so to speak. But I was only up there a couple of weeks, and then I went back to Dallas on another high-rise.
Okay. That's another question I wanted to ask you. Every now and then I'll see these photos of iron workers putting in the last piece of steel or a pin in a bridge or some sort of the final steel. And
that's usually referred to as the topping out beam.
Okay. Would that be true for a bridge as well?
Yeah. But the difference between a bridge job and a high rise, on the high rise, they'll paint the, usually the last beam white. Everybody, you know, all the big shots, everybody wants to sign their name on it. They'll have a big ceremony. You know, we'll have the customary Christmas tree on it, an American flag, and usually whatever state we're in, and then the local union that particular job's out of, they'll have their logo on it. And, you know, but on the bridge, you know, most of the time we'll just like hang a, you know, put the customary tree on it and hang a flag or whatever. Have a little ceremony, just, you know, setting the last piece.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. I mean, it's an internal kind of ceremony. It's not like opening dedication. It's not like a big, you know, the mayor's going to give a speech. It seems like it's more, it's the team, it's the iron workers realizing, all right, we got this one done. Is that right? Is my perception of that correct?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
Okay. That's pretty cool. All right, so we are kind of 1984-ish, going back to Dallas. Man, they were building a lot of stuff there, huh?
Yeah, and I went from, and in that time frame, Beasley had work going all over.
Hmm.
And Beasley owned, I think, 27 guy derricks, but we had 34 working. We were so busy, we had them rented from F&M MAFCO.
Wow.
And I went about a year or so in there from, like, end of 84 and about all of 85. About all I did was either put derricks up or take them down. Or go somewhere and jump them if they had a hard jump. They'd send me in there, you know, get it jumped and get it back working. And then I'd jump on the plane and I'd go to Reno. Then I'd jump on the plane and I'd go to Cleveland. And I'd jump on the plane and I'd go to Dallas or I'd go to Houston. Or
wow. At least you could sleep on the plane.
Oh, even to this day, I'm usually asleep before we ever take off.
Yeah, I bet. Wow. Okay, so lots of derricks.
In that same time frame, you know, went through there, the latter part of 84, about all of 85, first half of 86. You know, I was just bouncing all over the place. I might go to a bridge job for 3 months to help them get done, just as a filler, you know, until they needed me somewhere else. And then I'd go finish a high rise and take the derricks down. Then I'd go to a different bridge. And I just kind of bounced all over the place.
Did you like that, or did you wish you were on a one job for, you know, start to finish?
To me, it didn't matter. It was just work.
Okay. All right.
Really, the only drawback to it is when you had to go in and take over one that was what we refer to as upside down, that wasn't going like it should go.
Hmm.
You know, them kind of suck because you'd always, you know, the workers were pissed off. The general contractor was pissed off. You know, my bosses were pissed off because it wasn't going the way they had bid it and planned. And
oh.
When you go in to do them, I mean, it's kind of a no-win situation. So you just have to go in there with kind of a Marine Corps drill sergeant mentality. This is the way it's going to be. You either fall in here and help us get done, or You can stand across the street and watch this get done. It makes
right.
no difference to me.
Right. How often would that happen? Because I can think of, you know, a company like Beasley, if you missed your bid, you know, if you underbid a job, that could be financially very detrimental. No matter how hard the workers would work,
you'd be surprised how often it happens even today.
Okay.
That's like this bridge I'm doing now. The estimate department missed so much.
Oh, man.
I mean, so this job was going to be a loser before I ever started.
Whoa.
The only way I could, from the field erection standpoint, show it as a good project is to do it with less man hours than what was in the bid.
Yeah, wow. I mean, the only way you can do that is either you cut back hours or you try to just, you know, work double time.
I got sent to Dallas one time. This would have been I was 86, 87. I was up in Ohio. So this would have been like in 89. They had a 40-story building in Dallas. And it was only up 6 floors, and they had already written the job off as a loss.
Oh, no.
And I was in Dallas for something. A quarterly meeting, you know, through the superintendents, and that job come up, and I'm just like, how can it be considered a loss if you're only on the 6th floor and you got to go to 40? I go, that's, you know, that's still 6-8 months worth of work that you still have to do.
Right.
And of course, I was young and cocky. I said, I'm like, I ain't seen the drawings, hadn't even seen the job. And I like to gamble and I like to bet. I said, but I'll bet you $5,000 cash that I can do that job and make money on it. Well, the area project manager that was over that, he was just like, well, I don't think you can. But he goes, I'll take your bet. And I said, okay. I said, but we're talking real money. I said, when that job is done, if it makes $1 profit, that's considered a win. And you'll owe me $5,000. I said, and if it loses a dollar, I'll owe you $5,000. Then I reached down in my damn Wrangler pocket and I pulled out a wad of money and laid it on the table. I said, there's my $5,000 right there. He's like, well, I don't have mine on me, but he goes, I'm good for it. And I looked at Bill Landfair, who owned Beasley at the time, and Bill kind of nodded. He's like, he'll make it right. I said, okay. I said, I'll be back down here in a week. And I had to go to Ohio and get all my stuff. Anyway, I come to Dallas, and I said, it ain't going to be pretty. I said, but I'm going to take that job over. And I said, I got $5,000 of Roddy Mac dollars tied up in it. I'll make a difference. So I showed up. Just showed up on the job. Like I was just coming to help. So I walk into the office and can't even remember the guy's name that was running it, but it was like his first superintendent job.
Oh.
and he had a bunch of his buddies. He was a local guy there in Dallas, you know. And they wasn't getting shit done. I made the tour. I went up the building, come back down the building, you know, spent a half a day just observing. After work, I went down to my Beasley's office and talked to Bill Lanfer. I said, okay, well, here's what I'm going to do. And I told him who all I was firing. And Bill's like, you ain't gonna make any friends. I said, I didn't come here to make friends. So I showed up the next morning, and I was in the office when the timekeeper, Shirley Curry, showed up. She's like, what are you doing here, Ronnie Mack? I said, well, it's my job now, Shirley. She's like, well, I figured that was coming whenever I seen you here yesterday and the way you was. She goes, the look on your face.
Mm.
So then when the superintendent and his foreman started showing up, he was like, what are you doing here? I said, I'm taking over. I'm like, your services are no longer required. I handed him his check. I handed him all his foremen that wasn't worth the shit, their checks. Of course, you know, by that time, word had already spread, so all the hands were lined up around the trailer. The foremen were all butt hurt. They're just like, oh, damn, they run us off. So I just stepped out on the little porch of the office, and I'm just like, let me have all of your attention here a minute. I go, here's where we're at on this job. The company has written it off as a loser because y'all's on the 6th floor and you should be on the 30th floor by now. I go, I'm taking over. I fired the foreman. You men that are working in the gangs, here's your choice. You either go to work and give me an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. I said, or I'll fire every one of you and start all over. Well, probably 90% of them walked off.
Hmm.
I said, hell, dope. Out of the 20 that stayed, I went through them and like, yo, what do you do? What do you do? Yo, so I come up with enough guys to have a racing gang hanging iron. And I had enough guys to bulk up, and I had enough guys to do that.
Okay.
So then I just called the hall, the union hall. And I told him, I said, I need 15 guys. He said, well, you're just going to have a hard time getting anybody because you run off some good people. I said, I run off worms. I go, they were riding the gravy train with both feet dragging in the gravy. I go, them days are done. And it's like, you can either send me 15 guys or I'm going to bring in 15 guys. He said, well, you'll just have to bring in people. I said, that's fine. So I just started calling around the country the guys I knew.
Oh, nice.
You know, and brought them in there. So, long story short, we went from a job that they had written off as a loser. And when it was all said and done at the end, it made 20% profit.
Wow.
And I stepped in that office. When we went to do closeout on it, we went down the list. And I looked over at Bill Lanfair and like, what was the final tally? Of course, they're over on their calculators and shit, punching numbers and back and forth. He was just like, I just don't see how you done it. He said, but it made 20%.
Wow.
And I looked at that little project manager. I'm like, I believe you owe me $5,000. He was just like, well, I don't have $5,000 on me. I said, well, you knew this day was coming. I look at Landfair, I'm just like, you can take it out of his wages and pay me, or I'll take it out of his ass. But one way or another, I'm getting $5,000. It's either going to be cash or satisfaction. And I said, if I had to take it out of his ass, I'm just like, that's going to be a lot of ass whippings. Landfair got up and went into the counting room and had him cut me a check for $5,000.
Wow.
Then he told, I can't remember that guy's last name. It was Forrest. Forrest was his first name. No, it wasn't Gump either. We'll say it's like Forrest Wheeler or whatever. Anyway, he lasted about another year and Landfair ran him off.
So most of this time in the 80s, it sounds like you're doing buildings. You're doing high rises and steel buildings and not a lot of bridges.
Well, I helped them finish probably 6 bridges in that time frame.
Okay.
But that'd be like 3 months on this one. Then I'd go do a building. And then I'd go to Louisville, help them finish that one out. I mean, it's just kind of wherever they needed the help at when they needed it.
Yeah. One of the things I'm curious about is when the Navajo Bridge build came up, Kramer with a K was the contractor, and they subcontracted out the bridge build to Traylor, Traylor. And was Beasley still in business at the time?
No. But part of it was, but Bill Landfair had sold it to Frank Williams. Frank Williams got more interested in trying to sell insurance than be a steel erector.
Oh.
And he sold the bridge division to Traeger Brothers.
Okay.
So that's how you ended up with Jay Rollins, all Beasley guys on that. And before Frank had sold it to Traeger Brothers, Jay Rollins and them guys was looking at the bridge, you know, to erect it. Beasley.
Okay, so Beasley knew about the bridge. They knew it was going to be built, and then the bridge division was sold to Traylor.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I just couldn't figure it out, because you and Ed and David and
Ed Cross.
And Ed Cross, you guys were all Beasley people. Okay. But that's going to be in, what was that, 92 or no, 93 when the bridge division got sold to Traylor?
I think it was in 92.
Okay. And was that, I mean, did you have any thoughts about that? It all the people you knew that you'd worked with for many years, y'all must have kind of been in, I don't know.
Here's kind of the way that deal went. Bill Landfair sold Beasley to Frank Williams in like 87. Well, Frank come in, met with all of us superintendents, and he put on this dog and pony spiel about going to make Beasley the biggest steel erector in the world. We're going to buy new cranes. We're going to get retooled up, blah, 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 blah. And then we'd go 6 months. He'd have another meeting. All they want to talk about was selling insurance.
Ooh.
Oh, well, if you buy this insurance, if you buy this insurance. And I stood up at that second meeting they had after they'd done their insurance bill, and they asked if anybody had any questions, and I stood up, and I'm just like, I think I speak for about everybody in the room. And I asked them, you remember when you first bought this, you come in here and you told everybody that you're just going to make us the number one steel erector in the world. You're just going to buy new cranes. Going to get us retooled up. You know, make us a force to be reckoned with. I'm like, here we are 2 years later in this deal. I'm like, I can't even get parts to fix the same shit that I've been working on for the last 10 years.
Hmm.
And I'm like, every time we have one of these meetings, it's about buying insurance. I said, we're going to be an insurance agent or we're going to be a steel erector. And I just got up and left the room.
Hmm.
And then as soon as I finished, I was doing a bridge job in Wheeling, West Virginia. As soon as I finished it, I was done with Beasley.
Okay. What year was that?
That would have been 91.
Okay. Had you worked with Ed Kent on any jobs? I think I've asked you this already, and maybe Navajo, was Navajo your first job with Ed?
No, I'd worked with Ed in New Orleans when he did that Greater New Orleans Bridge.
Okay.
And I'd worked with Ed up in Moundsville, West Virginia on that bridge.
When was the Greater New Orleans?
That would have been like 83, 84.
Okay.
And it was one of them deals, you know, whenever I was bouncing around and I was down there for about 3 or 4 months.
Can you tell me an Ed Kent story from the 80s that you remember?
So many, my mind's just going to try to pick out.
Well, we've been yik-yakking for almost an hour now. So maybe that's a good question for next time. Because pretty soon here,
Ed always had a lot of stories about, you know, different bridges he'd been on and different things that happened. You know, most of the time they'd be laughing about some damn practical joke bullshit they had played on somebody else, or, you know. Because, I mean, the guys like Ed Kent, Ed Cross, Bob Peters, Jerry Kent, Lamar's son, they were notorious for fucking with each other.
Okay.
Just being honoring. You know, not ever mean nothing bad by it, but I mean, they'd do something to piss somebody off and just laugh. And then when they started laughing, they knew that, you know, they'd got played. Ed's biggest story always was, you know, guys would be half-assed or something, and Ed would just show up. And, you know, they'd be trying to drive pins to line something up and, you know, half-ass pecking around on them. And Ed's biggest saying always was, let me see you beat her, boy. And it didn't matter if the guy was 10 foot tall and bulletproof. Ed had the same comment, let me see you beat her, boy. You know, them other guys would be trying to drive a pin, and it would sound like tink, tink, tink. Ed would get that beater, and it'd go, whoom, whoom. Ed would drive 6 or 8 pins. He goes, that's how you do it. Y'all just ain't putting enough ass behind it. And I've had to do the same thing out here on this bridge. Guys pecking around. I'm like, hit that damn thing like you're mad at.
Yeah.
And I get their beater. I'm like, just listen to the sound. And I start driving the pin. I'm like, don't that sound like Jimmy Page playing a Led Zeppelin song? You can tell by the tone, it's different.
Yeah, I like that. Hit it like you're mad at it. Well, I think we're about ready to get to Navajo Bridge here. We've gone through. You're leaving.
Yeah, we're right up there close to it.
Yep. Leaving Beasley in 91. Okay. Well, maybe this is a good time to wrap up this part 2. And we'll get into Navajo Bridge good and proper next time.
Okay.
Is there anything else you want to add to the interview we just did?
Oh, God, you're the one asking the questions.
Well, I know. That's why I ask this general catch-all question at the end. If you're like, well, he didn't ask me about XYZ, and I want to make sure I tell him. I always ask, and most people say no, but I always ask. And if you're good with it, then we will wrap this up.
I'm good with it.
Okie doke. This will conclude part 2. Of a Grand Canyon oral history with Ronnie Mack. Today is Thursday, July 21, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Ronnie, thank you so very much.
All right, thank you.